Hi, this is Hold Your Fire, a podcast by the International Crisis Group. I'm Richard Atwood. On Monday, the 15th of April, a war that has laid waste to Sudan will enter its second year.
Chaos as fighting breaks out on the streets of Khartoum, civilians running for their lives. In the sky, fighter jets carry out devastating airstrikes. The country torn apart in a power struggle between the paramilitary group known as the Rapid Support Force and Sudan's army.
Our regular listeners will know much of what's happened. In 2019, protesters took to the streets across Sudan in opposition to long-serving ruler Omar al-Bashir. After Bashir's ouster, Sudan's armed forces, the SAF, led by Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, and a paramilitary force, the Rapid Support Forces, the RSF, led by Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, or Hameti, had first agreed to share power with civilians. In 2021, though, they dissolved the civilian government, seized power in a coup, and then, in April last year, turned on each other. After heavy fighting destroyed much of the capital, Khartoum, the RSF had, by the end of last year, mostly seized the city, and other cities Omdurman and Bari in the greater Khartoum area. The RSF also routed the army from most of Darfur in Sudan's west and advanced east into Jazeera State and its capital Madani. Burhan and the army command had by then recamped to Port Sudan on the Red Sea and the country's northeast. But since January this year, the army has pushed back.
Their fighting is scrappy and ill-disciplined. But the militiamen of Sudan's rebel Rapid Support Forces are not without support. Their camouflage appears to be from the United Arab Emirates, their main backers. Their opponents, the Sudan Armed Forces, are also scrappy. But in the last few days, they've pushed the RSF out of most of Omdurman, in part because they're now reported to be getting weapons from Iran.
A year of fighting has provoked what UN officials say is one of the world's worst humanitarian disasters in recent memory. They also now warn of famine.
It's the largest displacement crisis in the world. Nearly 8 million Sudanese have fled their homes. They need food, shelter and healthcare. But most of all, they need peace. For regional countries to broker a negotiated settlement and stop arming two factions who care only about power and not about the people of Sudan.
So for more background on the war, the Sudanese army, the roots and history of the Rapid Support Forces and Hameti, please do check out several episodes we've done over the course of this past year. Today, we're going to look at where things stand now, and we're going to reflect back on what a year of war has done to Sudan and its people. I'm happy to welcome back onto the show Shawit Walde-Mikhail, who is Crisis Group Sudan expert, and Alan Boswell, our Horn of Africa director. Shawit, Alan, welcome back on.
Thank you, Richard.
Thanks for having us back on, Richard.
So let's start then with an overview of the fighting. As we just heard, the RSF had seemed until the end of last year to have the upper hand. But over the past few months, the army has regained ground. Do you want to talk a bit about how that's happened?
Well, the war has entered a new phase since the beginning of this year, with the Sudanese armed forces launching major offensives against the RSF, particularly in Greater Khartoum, including Omdurman and Bahri. And this marks significant victories by the army for the first time since the conflict began last year. The army has, since January, reclaimed territory along the Nile in Omdurman, gradually extending southwards and eastwards. The army's offensive has also expanded into Bahri, which has witnessed intense battles between SAF and RSF since the conflict started last year. The army's attempt to recapture Al Jazeera have yielded mixed results. They are supported in this fight by popular resistance forces and Darfuri armed groups, and they've tried to launch offensives from three fronts, but the RSF seems to have managed to maintain its positions in most parts of Jazeera and definitely in Madani. But unfortunately, the conflict in Jazeera has spilled over to adjacent states that are bordering Ethiopia. There are also ongoing conflicts in Baba Nusa in West Kordofan state, where the army and the RSF have been fighting for months now. There are also skirmishes in northern Darfur's capital, Al Fashir, where the RSF had previously made deals with Darfuri armed groups to not attack the city. But recently, this truce seems to be unraveling, as many of these groups have aligned with the army and are currently fighting alongside its forces in Jazeera. There is definitely a risk this will escalate into an all-out conflict in North Darfur.
And what explains the army's changes in fortunes? As you say, more difficult in Jazeera state, but at least around Khartoum, how's it been able to push back?
Well, the ability of the army to push back, I mean, first of all, they didn't have any choice but to push back because it seems like the RSF was marching towards Port Sudan from Madani. But what underlines their success, first of all, is the atrocities committed by the RSF troops and allied militia in Madani and in Jazeera as a whole has really galvanized popular resistance against the RSF. So SAF forces are supported by thousands of civilian militia, Darfuri armed groups that have declared their support, and well-trained Islamist brigades who also hail from these riverine areas. River Nile, northern state. Undoubtedly, the use of Iranian-made drones have played a significant role.
And we'll talk about the Islamist brigades that you mentioned, Shawit, and some of the other forces fighting alongside the SAF in a moment. But just to check, the army's confirmed buying drones from Iran?
So the army hasn't openly admitted to having purchased Iranian drones, but SAF-affiliated diplomats that we have spoken to have told us that they have purchased weapons, including drones from Iran. And these drones have demonstrated superior precision in targeting RSF forces, particularly in urban areas like Khartoum and Omdurman, and effectively targeting supply lines and reinforcements.
And initially in Khartoum, the RSF, I mean, tell me if this is right, but the RSF was largely sort of fighting on the ground, the army bombing from the air. But what does the combat actually look like now across the different fronts?
Yes. So, I mean, the RSF from the very beginning has been very mobile on pickup trucks and other vehicles, moving very quickly from area to area. They are good at urban warfare, I would say. They travel lightly, crisscrossing in Khartoum, in Omdurman. They attack SAF positions and then they retreat. On the other hand, SAF employs this old school military tactics and they have been in a defensive position since the very beginning. But with the joining of these different Islamic brigades that are increasingly fighting exactly as the RSF is fighting on mobile trucks, vehicles, there have been direct combat on the streets of Khartoum and Omdurman, but the significant shift in conflict came about because of this high-precision drone attacks since, I would say, February of this year.
So I want to come in a moment to sort of internal dynamics on both sides, but can we just take stock of what a year of war has done to the Sudanese people, the humanitarian situation? We heard up top, 8 million displaced, many have left Khartoum, more than 24 million people, I think, need aid. That's about half the population, including in areas that are hard to access. There's now warnings about potential famine.
I mean, the humanitarian situation has been terrible since the beginning of the conflict. Millions have been displaced and tens of thousands killed because of the conflict or because of hunger and very terrible health situations since the collapse of state services in Sudan. But in terms of food security, IDPs in camps in Darfur, particularly that depend on humanitarian aid, have been worst hit. Similarly, those trapped in urban areas, like in Omdurman, Madani, or Jazeera as a whole, in Baba Nusa, are facing serious food shortages. Other communities like pastoralists in Darfur have lost their livestock mostly and their livelihoods, and they're also at risk. Only RSF-controlled area that is getting a bit of aid is West Darfur, where aid agencies unilaterally have decided to deliver food and other aid.
And Shawit, it's mostly, from what I understand, with the exception of northern Darfur, it's mostly the RSF-held areas that are struggling to get aid, and that's because UN aid agencies recognise the SAF as the government, so it's difficult to get aid in through borders in areas the RSF controls. Is that right?
Yes. Unlike the AU, which suspended Sudan after the October 2021 coup, and doesn't recognize neither Burhan or Hemeti as legitimate political leaders of Sudan, the UN recognizes Burhan as the legitimate government. And the UN and other agencies can directly deliver aid because the army and Burhan refuse to allow aid into RSF-held areas.
Richard, just to add that using food as a tactic in war is a decades-old tactic in Sudan. The officials who more or less run Burhan's security services, many these are still largely run by Bashir-era officials. They have a long experience of manipulating foreign aid, the UN system. We shouldn't be surprised that they are essentially blocking aid into most of their enemies' territories. It essentially starves out rural areas, it starves out areas of their enemies. Part of the benefit would be that RSF-held areas depopulate even more. It's obviously a very brutal tactic, but it's one that we've seen for a very long time. And frankly, the aid system has never found a good way of getting around this. But as Shewitt said, the diplomatic norms often state that if a government is the recognized government, that according to sovereignty, they need to, they need to get permission to do some of this aid delivery. So we need to see donors open their wallets more than they have, but we also need to see more political pressure and just a demand that millions of Sudanese are not allowed to starve, essentially because one side of the civil war doesn't mind if they do. Just one more thing. It's not like RSF is any saint in this matter. They've also blockaded and tried to blockade areas under SAF control. They also have tried charging exorbitant checkpoint fees to aid trucks coming into their areas and have been known to loot aid as well. So the blame goes on both sides of this.
And the warnings of famine?
Yeah. One thing for everyone to be aware of, the body that is officially designated to declare famines has admitted publicly that they do not have the data to properly assess the conditions inside Sudan right now. So they have not updated their analyses of the food security situation since December, even though they are warning that there's a serious risk of famine. So the body that's supposed to declare famine has essentially raised its hands and said it's unable to do so because it doesn't have the data it would need.
Do we have a sense? Is it possible to get a sense of the numbers that are at risk of starving to death?
There have been third-party organizations that have run scenarios that show, by their math, millions of Sudanese, perhaps famine that the modern world hasn't seen in recent memory. Not everyone buys those methodologies, but for sure there are lots of reasons to be very concerned, especially in Darfur and in the greater Khartoum area.
So let's move then to the two sides, and maybe we could start with the SAF, with the Sudanese army. Shewitt, you mentioned earlier that it was very reliant on these Islamist militias, I mean, these sort of Bashir-era Islamists for the fighting, and also that some of the sort of Darfuri non-Arab forces were also involved in Jazeera. How coherent are the other forces fighting against the RSF?
Well, when it comes to SAF, I mean, when it comes to their fight against the RSF, they're coherent with the various armed movements and militias and Islamic brigades that are fighting alongside them. We've seen tension in recent months because of how to control these affiliated militias and forces. And a recent statement by General Kabashi comes to mind.
And General Kabashi, maybe just remind people who he is.
Kabashi is Burhan's deputy. So his recent statement was very clear about the need to rein in some of those militias, the Mustafarine, the public resistance, and the different Islamic brigades, in how to arm them, but also for them to be under the command and control of SAF officers. I think we've seen different videos of some armed forces beheading people, targeted killings in areas controlled by SAF, and this created a bit of fear that these forces are operating independently of SAF command. So this, I think, is why he made that statement. And soon after, in what is widely believed to be a response to his speech, Yasser Al-Atta, who is the third in command in the armed forces, said this is not the time to try to control these forces, that they need to be armed, there needs to be more mobilization. And it gave an impression that there was some kind of division within the army when it comes to how these allied forces should be controlled and whether SAF can actually control these forces.
So just to add on to where Shawit left off there, the coherence of both of these sides of the war is a huge concern of ours. We've talked about this on previous podcasts, but the trend lines of fragmentation are very worrying. On the SAF side, you know, we're basically worried about a potential split in SAF. You could see Burhan leads something like a coalition of generals and others fighting on his side, and his own leadership somehow floats above this but isn't considered very strong. So concerns the army could split, especially if peace talks accelerate and you have hardliners and some of these ex-Bashir Islamist sort of forces opposing it and possibly splintering off on their own. There's also a problem of the army basically receding further, almost into the background, the army losing control of its own war, so to speak, amid all these other forces.
Alan, can I just, I mean, in the past, we've talked about the army. The army just doesn't have a strong infantry or mobile units. It hasn't really been able to do the ground fighting. And in the past, the army's relied on groups like the RSF. In some ways, the RSF was the army's infantry. But now the SAF is sort of forced to rely more on these Islamist militias that we talked about and the non-Arab Darfuri forces.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, it's worth taking a quick step back and saying why the army has done this. And it's that the Sudanese army, for decades, but especially under Bashir's rule, has relied heavily on militias, irregular forces, either Islamist forces usually or ethnic militias, to fight its dirty wars around the peripheries. And the RSF had become the strongest of those various ones. And yes, many Sudanese will say that the army is basically fighting its own infantry because that's how much they had stopped focusing on actually building a real army that can fight ground wars. And this has led to kind of a coalition of its different proxy militias from the past and present. And it's a bit awkward because some of these Darfur groups that you referenced were actually rebel groups fighting against the Sudanese government. And now they're on the Sudanese government side. Much of this mobilization has taken place very much on ethnic lines. So you have Burhan sort of not only sitting above a fractious set of generals within the actual formal army institution, you also then have this collection of other militias, none of whom plan to go away quietly if and when this war ends. They will want to somehow be part of what comes next as well. RSF faces a different problem, which is that RSF remains tightly under the control of Hemeti and his immediate family, so there's no real concern of a split in RSF or a leadership struggle at the top. The problem is that RSF can, you know, fray into many different pieces and already has and does to a variety of degrees because outside of its core leadership, it remains this loose sort of coalition of militias, also just recruits who are very motivated by getting war bounty and loot. So there's a different concern on the RSF side than the SAF side.
Just before we move to the outside involvement, do Burhan is in Port Sudan, but do people know where Hemeti is?
Well, actually, nobody knows. A number of people say he's in Libya. Others say he's in the UAE. Others say he's in Uganda. So it's very difficult to say.
But people don't think he's in Khartoum or in Sudan itself, right? So what, it's his brother, Abdul Rahim, who's there?
Even Abdul Rahim is not, I don't think he is in Sudan at the moment. The last time he was seen, it was in Madani, and then he went to Baba Nusa, I heard, but now nobody knows where exactly he is. Other people assume he went to Cairo and then to the UAE.
And when you talk to Sudanese outside the country, you sort of get the sense that both sides are widely reviled. The RSF have been responsible seemingly for atrocities in Darfur in particular, a lot of looting, the army has shelled Khartoum. But as the war continues, are people sort of being forced to pick sides more than just sort of being disgusted at both of them?
Yeah, we still call this war as a war between SAF and RSF, but, you know, it's increasingly something that's really a war primarily on ethnic and regional lines breaking off across the country. Of course, sometimes within communities as well, but often between them. So it is very complicated. It's not just just East versus West, but you do have a couple of defining cleavages. You have this Arab, non-Arab cleavage in Darfur, which, you know, was there 20 years ago when the civil war in Darfur was especially raging.
And Alan, that cleavage, broadly speaking, is the RSF, who are mostly Arabs from Darfur, from that sort of region, fighting or pitted against other Darfuri groups. And some of those non-Arab Darfuris, as we talked about earlier, are now fighting with the SAF, fighting with the army against the RSF, including outside Darfur in Jazeera.
Yes, exactly. And then you do have especially this RSF versus what's mostly a northerner riverine communities who historically have been dominant in Sudan. That warfare along that line has grown increasingly very much on ethnic lines. The hate speech is profound. Both groups sort of target the others within areas that they do control. And we're seeing that basically spread to almost all areas of Sudan, even where the war hasn't hit. You see people targeted based off their ethnicity. So it's a war that's increasingly reaching into all corners. Many Sudanese have tried to stay out of it, but for those on the ground, it's increasingly hard to find yourself just in an anti-war position because the war is sort of sweeping up entire communities.
And let's move then to the outside involvement. So maybe let's start with the Emiratis, who's again sort of widely accepted that the Emiratis have been backing, arming the rapid support forces. That support seemed decisive, or at least influential, in the sort of RSF's advances towards the end of last year. But has that has the Emiratis' position evolved at all?
Well, yes and no. Diplomats and officials working on this, I don't know any that think the UAE has significantly cut back on its support to RSF politically or materially. But we have seen a change, I think, from the UAE in terms of its position towards the war. For most of this war, the UAE was essentially squeezed out of peace talks because those took place in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. Relations between Saudi Arabia and UAE have been quite tense. But then we had in January, there were quiet peace talks between the deputies of the two sides. So Hemeti's brother and then General Kabashi, Burhan's deputy on the SAF side. And they met in Manama. There was a series of talks led basically by the Egyptian and the Emirati intelligence services. And then a U.S. and a Saudi representative were later invited. This was a huge development because you have Egypt, who's the main backer of the army on one side, and you had the Emiratis on the other, who themselves have their own relations. The UAE recently announced a huge 30-some billion dollar package to Egypt. There's reasons to think that warming of relations between Cairo and Abu Dhabi have made cooperation on Sudan easier. And what we've heard from officials is they see, you know, is there's a sense that the UAE does think that this war is spiraling out of control and that it does want to see an end to the war.
And that's particularly, Alan, because of the Iranian drones going in and the fact that the army has been able to push back and the sort of quick win that maybe the Emirates thought they could get from the RSF doesn't look like it's going to materialize.
I mean, we would argue that fueling this war never made sense. Neither side can win. And the longer it goes on, the more and more you have an obviously broken state. It's very hard to see how any of that would benefit the UAE or anyone else. Plus, you have the resurgence of the Islamists, whom the UAE always opposed. And yes, you have Iran coming in. So there are many reasons to do it. Having Egypt in the UAE, and I should include Saudi Arabia in there as well, these three big Arab powers, it looked like it would be a prerequisite to have those three sort of on the same page about ending this war, assuming the belligerents were not going to walk to the negotiating table themselves, which is definitely not something that we've seen.
So, of course, it's good that the Emirates may be more inclined to push Hemeti to compromise. Though, in some ways, hasn't he always been the readier party, at least to talk? Maybe the settlement he envisages, the role he wants for himself, you know, is not something the army or many Sudanese will accept. But he has seemed prepared to talk, whereas it's the army, the SAF, that's been more reluctant.
Yes, it would be fair to say that the UAE seems to have a lighter lift because Hemeti has been the more keen party to negotiate. That doesn't mean Hemeti has wanted compromise on terms that most Sudanese would find acceptable, but presumably they don't have to do a lot of arm twisting to get the RSF to the negotiating table. So yes, that puts more onus on the Egyptian side, on other allies of SAF to somehow convince Burhan, who's been very keen to sort of wiggle out of peace talks anytime they've gained any traction.
And that's because of the fractious nature of the army and the forces that are fighting with it? Or it's just that Burhan didn't want to talk from a position of weakness?
It's several factors. I do think Burhan, the officer corps, and many Sudanese who back the army, or at least very much hated the RSF, you know, they don't see equivalence between the two sides. They see a national army versus what they see as a genocidal militia. But there's a couple other factors, one of which is, as Shawit outlined and as we've talked about, the RSF had all the momentum, at least through the first about 9 months. And it was obvious that Burhan was not keen to negotiate with a losing hand. But then the other obvious component of it is that the ceasefire talks have all been in the Arab world, the talks in Saudi Arabia, and then these Egyptian Emirati ones. All of those have been premised on an equation that Burhan turns on these ex-Bashir Islamist forces, essentially isolates them, like what happened after Bashir fell in 2019, pushes them out of the political and security sphere. It's obvious to see when Burhan is so reliant on many of those forces internally, both to run his government and fight the war, why that's a very hard ask of Burhan. And it's a dilemma that I think officials have probably not thought hard enough about. If you want Burhan to turn on these guys, what must you offer him that would even enable him to do that? And I think that's a quandary that perhaps people haven't looked at as directly as they need to.
Does it even make sense to try to isolate these Islamist forces that are fighting precisely because they felt that they were the big losers after the revolution in the first place?
Yeah, it's an important question, but to say many Sudanese, you know, this was basically the basis of the Sudanese transition and the basis of the power sharing deal that was there before this war broke out. So it's something like the status quo ante, so to speak. But the other thing is, it does seem to unite more or less the outside powers who are invested in this war. So it's unclear if you'd be able to unite them in the same way if you didn't push out the Islamists. But the point you raise is a very good one, which is there needs to probably be some more realistic thinking about how to incentivize the Islamist forces to also want this war to end as well.
So on the SAF side, on Burhan's side, even if you can get him to the table, there's this issue of what happens to the Islamists. And Shawit, as you talked about earlier, maybe even some disagreement in the SAF, in the army over that. But what are the other main sticking points between the parties, areas that they're negotiating over, even before getting to a ceasefire?
So there are a number of sticking points, and one has to do with the preconditions for ceasefire negotiations. The first one from the SAF side is for the RSF to exit all urban areas, including Khartoum, Omdurman, Bahri, and Al Jazeera altogether. And the RSF are not willing to compromise on this issue. So this is a major sticky point. Obviously, what's going to happen to both Hemeti and Burhan is another critical issue. They say that they have agreed that there is a need for one national unified army. SAF wants the RSF to merge their forces, those soldiers who were part of the RSF before the conflict started. And the RSF is demanding that the armed forces have to be disbanded and reformed from scratch and include all the armed groups across Sudan. This is a major point of contention. So they're facing significant issues they need to address, which is not going to be easy, particularly because it's not very popular amongst people living under in the east, in the north, for the army to negotiate at all with the RSF. They're demanding that the army defeats the RSF because of the atrocities committed by RSF soldiers and affiliated militia. The RSF, even though it's led by Hemeti and his family, they also have to answer to their supporters in Darfur, but also across Sudan that have joined them for various reasons, but hope that they're going to maybe share power, the RSF has started to form committees, administrative units, and their proposal for the different regions to be led by locals is appealing to many in these areas. So it's going to be very difficult going forward for a political process where SAF demands that a technocratic government be formed, whereas the RSF prefers for the different political actors to be very much part of a political transition process.
So we haven't spoken yet about the civilian side. Could you maybe unpack that a bit and tell me if this is right? But people seem to mean different things when they talk about civilian leaders. Sometimes even the leaders of Darfuri armed groups are lumped in with the civilians. So when people talk about a return to civilian rule, civilians leading a post-war transition, who do they usually mean?
After the ouster of Bashir, civilians referred to all parties and institutions that opposed his government and brought about political change in Sudan. The Forces for Freedom and Change, the FFC, which was formed in 2019, came to represent the biggest civilian coalition in Sudan at the time. Members included the Sudanese Professional Association, the Darfuri armed groups, different political parties, resistance committees, and so many other civic forces, women's groups, youth groups, you name it. But a significant split happened within the FFC, and they split into the Central Council and the Democratic Bloc. And many other civil and political forces also distanced themselves from the FFC Central Council. After the conflict, they have tried to regroup into the Taqaddum, an anti-war civilian coalition. Although they have provided one of the very few organized civilian movements against the war, it is difficult to say how much influence they have over the warring parties or communities that are backing its side. I mean, this is not to say that they won't be important, but clearly a political process will have to involve many more actors that are not part of this coalition. And this might mean many actors who are taking part in the war, such as the Darfur armed groups.
So, Richard, I think what a lot of this really shows is that the term civilian in Sudan, which is used a lot in terms of getting back to civilian rule, the civilians versus the two belligerents, the term civilian is a problematic one at the at the moment, because, of course, there are many civilians in Sudan. And often when Western actors say civilian, what they mean are the elements of the Sudanese street, the activists, especially Sudanese youth who really drove the revolution and then, you know, formed these resistance committees and now often are involved in grassroots humanitarian activities, for instance. And then they also often mean essentially a collection of longtime political opposition elite who consider both the Sudanese army and the Sudanese Islamist movement its main and longtime enemies, and as a result have often found itself having the same enemies as RSF and at times getting into something like a de facto alliance with RSF as a result. That collection of political elite, they're mostly the ones who people came to refer to as the FFC, which Shiwit was referring to, and Taqaddum, which is another term Shiwit referred to. But anyways, you know, this is a small group of political opposition elite. When we say civilian, does it have to mean that power goes to these sorts of actors whom Burhan considers very much to be his enemies at the moment, to be allied to RSF? Or do we just mean going back to having civilian leaders, which would open up a far greater pool of options, and that if there was a ceasefire deal, both warring parties would actually be fine with having civilians be in leadership positions. Of course, they would want those civilians to not be more powerful than them. But is that what we mean by civilian? So anyways, that's just to say, I think the term civilian, I'm sure we'll keep using it even at crisis group, but I'm not sure it's been a terribly helpful one.
So, Alan, you talked earlier about the Egypt-Emirati track, which brought together the, as you said, the deputies of Hemeti's deputy, Borkhan's deputy, in the Bahraini capital, Maimana. But there's also the Jeddah track, involved the Saudis and the US. There are also efforts by the African Union, the Horn Regional Bloc, IGAD, also wanting to be involved. There's a new US envoy, finally, Tom Perriello, something were whose appointment we supported, plus a new United Nations envoy, the veteran Algerian diplomat Ramtane Lamamra, plus an array of Western mediators. So sort of if you're thinking through all these, clearly, as you said earlier, the Egyptians, the Emiratis, the Saudis need to be part of it. But what is the best format for making sure all this is joined up, or at least not working at cross purposes?
Sure. I think the best way of thinking about this now is that you have both informal, or I should say more or less secretive tracks and formal ones. The formal ones have all been inactive for months now, and we're not starting from a blank slate. So whether or not what would be the best way forward, it's very hard to get around Jeddah talks. Saudi Arabia is obviously a very huge power in this context. If you look at a map, you can see Saudi Arabia is basically a neighbor of Sudan. And so Jeddah is the one, is the formal track that everyone keeps coming back to, because it does already exist. But then these informal ones you've had much more progress on lately. So there was the Egyptian Emirati initiative, which we've already spoken about. Those informal discussions do continue, not in Manama, anymore, largely in Cairo. And to our knowledge, the parties have not met at senior levels, recently, but there is a fair amount of shuttle diplomacy going on. I had a top diplomat involved say that Burhan especially is keener on, is more open to discussing a deal than he is to negotiating. You know, that the optics of sort of showing up and talking to Hemeti are so poor right now. But that doesn't mean the sides aren't willing to continue discussing in their respective corners what a deal might look like. So I would say the diplomatic plan at the moment, to the degree there is one, is to really get Egypt, Saudi Arabia, UAE, and the U.S. is the other major player there, more or less on the same page, dealing with these belligerents, pushing closer to a deal, and that when they get close, try to bring a formal track back together again, make Jeddah into something that includes a lot more of these players, includes Egypt, includes the UAE. The African Union has a new high-level panel. They would like to be invited, but again, it comes down to they would like to not just be sitting around in a hotel lobby. They would like to have an actual role. Jeddah is plan A. There will be a number of negotiations, not just with the belligerents, but with all those different actors. That doesn't actually mean necessarily that most of the negotiations about what a final deal and endgame look like will actually take place in Jeddah. A lot of those, you know, might take place behind the scenes well before then.
And Alan, I mean, Shoei talked about some of the sticking points earlier. You also mentioned this challenge on the south side, which is sort of what's going to happen to the Islamist militias. But you've got the other army demand that the RSF pull out of urban areas. We've got the disagreement about with the respective armed forces. Got questions about the role of Borhan and Hemeti themselves, and many Sudanese who again want hope that power is going to be turned over to civilians as soon as possible. Is it at all clear what a deal might actually look like in the end?
I think the only deal that would be reachable is something that looks like a very minimal deal. That's not to say it would be a short-term ceasefire, because I think the parties would have to sign a deal that basically says what the end game is so that they'd stop fighting. But I don't think it would be a very extensive one. I think it would be something like a freezing of forces and a commitment to what the path forward would be, even if vague. And I just want to stress how bleak the picture is. There's plenty of reasons to doubt that, especially Burhan is keen anytime soon to sign a deal. But then, you know, if you play it forward where they do manage to get a ceasefire, you have RSF essentially in control of a huge part of the country, SAF in control of another. Presumably they will sign to unite under one army, you know, to have a civilian government, etc. But the actual ability of anyone to make these parties do that will obviously be very minimal. You could easily imagine a situation where they sign a document that pledges many things, but in reality, it's very hard to get the two to ever merge together. There's a more or less de facto split of sorts. Khartoum remains more or less contested. There's a messy political process that starts outside the country, but it's very hard to actually bring that political process back to Sudan itself. Burhan gets comfortable sitting in Port Sudan, supported by others who are very keen to keep the RSF very far away from the Red Sea and run something like a sort of military-led rump state. So even in a scenario where you end this war, I have to say people should probably be pretty realistic about what the path forward looks like from there. Because getting from a ceasefire to something that looks like a reunifying of Sudan would be, you know, a very steep path. I can imagine an end to the fighting easier than I can imagine something that starts to look like Sudan piecing back together after that.
And so, you know, with that picture in mind, prospects of returning to some sense of Sudan as a unified country looking pretty bleak. We're a year into what's been a devastating war. Obviously, we heard about the civilian toll, and that's really just the start of it, right? That a country that's sort of pivotal in between the Red Sea, North Africa, the Sahel, the Horn, has in many ways, as you said earlier, collapsed. Do you want to reflect a bit on what the past year of war, what it's meant for Sudan and Sudanese people, and how it might go if diplomatic efforts don't even yield that ceasefire that you talked about, Alan?
The impact of the conflict in Sudan has been profound. While it's very difficult to quantify a loss of life, thousands and tens of thousands have been a direct casualty of the conflict between the army and the RSF, as well as indirect casualties due to malnutrition, disease, and a lack of access to healthcare. The country has been completely destroyed. Communities have been militarized. And it's increasingly turning into an ethnic conflict, both in Darfur, but it seems like also the RSF and communities that support it are being pitted against northerners or riverines. We've seen the proliferation of armed movements who have rushed to join either the RSF or SAF. And, you know, rather than decreasing irregular forces in Sudan, it has actually exponentially increased the number of armed forces in Sudan. It's going to significantly impact the region and in neighboring countries, particularly for years to come.
Yeah, I don't want to skip past just what a catastrophic famine situation might be looming ahead for Sudan if they're unable to get a ceasefire and more aid into the country. I know we talk a lot about humanitarian catastrophes, you know, in Africa and many other war zones, and you talk about it with guests in other places. But from what we hear, what might happen in Sudan might be, you know, something like we haven't seen in decades, basically, if nothing changes. But I think secondly on that, the speed and the scale of the collapse that we've seen in Sudan is hard for, I think, people to fully grapple with because, you know, again, there are many different civil wars, ones that have killed even more people. The war in northern Ethiopia that took place, you know, a couple years ago, that probably killed more people, but it didn't wreak the same level of destruction on the state of Ethiopia. Sudan essentially is gone. Even if you stop this war as discussed, it would be very hard to even get back to where Sudan was over a year ago. I think it's just very difficult for everyone to process that. I don't want to be fatalistic. I don't want to say it's impossible. But once the middle class, the elite, once a capital has collapsed, it's very hard to piece it all back together. The number of armed groups now involved, none of those armed groups are just going to go away if all this finishes. It is a huge catastrophe. I think the regional implications will take a while for everyone to digest. Sudan was a buffer between North Africa, between the Horn, between the Sahel, and, you know, the Gulf and Levant on the other side of the Red Sea. That buffer has now collapsed. It's essentially thrown the Sahel into the Middle East. It's thrown North Africa into the Horn of Africa. We will see a lot as a consequence of that. We might already see a huge political crisis in South Sudan because its main export pipeline, pumping the oil to export, which is what the government entirely relies on for revenues, that's fallen into disrepair. But that will not be the final sort of spillover. So I think my main reflection, you know, besides the utter tragedy of it, is I still think everyone is not fully grasping the scale of that tragedy, getting back to where Sudan was even a year and a half ago. But I think the path there, no one should underestimate how steep that would be.
Alan, Shewit, thanks for coming on again.
Thanks so much, Richard.
Thank you.
Hold Your Fire is a production of the International Crisis Group. I'm Richard Atwood. You can find all of our work on Sudan on our website, crisisgroup.org. Do check out our statement on the one-year anniversary of the war. Again, you can listen to previous Hold Your Fire episodes on Sudan if you want more background. Thanks to our producers, Kevin Murphy, Heiko Schaub, And thanks, as ever, to all of you. Our listeners, please do get in touch, podcast@crisisgroup.org, or write to me directly, atwood@crisisgroup.org. If you have any questions, suggestions, or concerns, if you like the show, please do leave us a nice review. It helps other people find us. And I very much hope that you'll join us again next time.